from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. At the age of 14, Diane Lake became one of the followers of the notorious criminal Charles Manson. We'll hear firsthand from her about the allure of Manson, who just died on Sunday. Then at 10:30, journalist Catherine Miles joins us and will give us a tour of cities across the United States susceptible to a major earthquake.
This is a national problem, and nearly every state in the union has real seismic hazard and risk.
She'll explain how woefully unprepared we are for a trembler, especially outside of California. And that's next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Charles Manson died on Sunday at the age of 83, 48 years after he masterminded a string of murders that horrified the nation. Our guest, Diane Lake, had a very different take on Manson. She was in love with him at the age of 14 and was the youngest member of the Manson family, as his followers were known. She joins us this segment to discuss her relationship with Manson and how she ultimately ended up as a key witness in the Manson trial and her new memoir, Member of the Family. And welcome, Diane Lake.
Thank you.
Well, I want to dispel a myth initially, and that is that your parents gave you away to Manson, because I know that's been over on the internet and so forth. Your parents did share drugs with you when you were young. Your grandfather molested you. I mean, it's quite a personal story you have here, and your parents were kind of classic hippie-dippies, you know, tune in, drop out, and all that. But actually, it was a guy named Richard who was a speed freak who introduced you to Manson and said he's a groovy guy.
That's right.
And yet he warned you later on about Manson, but it was too late?
He did, yes.
So let's talk about Manson, first of all, because you had close contact with him. You wound up testifying against him. And the reality is that you saw someone initially very different than the man we have come to know as Manson.
Yes, I did. When I first met Charlie, he was, you know, in a group with girls around him. He was playing guitar, drinking root beer. And he was, you know, I thought he was good looking. He had, you know, nice hair, and he was funny and kind of impish and playful and just, you know, really the opposite of how he's viewed now.
You even describe him at one point as tender. In fact, he did, you talk about his having sex with you when you were 14, which is kind of, well, it's not kind of. It's, I'm thinking about it in light of the same age as a young woman who's made it when she was 14 with Judge Moore now. I mean, this is a child, essentially. You were a child.
Yes, yes.
It's pedophilia. But he was gentle with you at first, and then the paranoia came out later, and the violence increased and abuse increased. And so
right,
forth.
Yeah. Right.
That was the trajectory.
Yes.
So the power that he had, though, I mean, this is one of the things, it's the demonic power that fascinates many people. There was almost a kind of Svengali quality that he had, mystifying over women, young women.
Yes, he was. Well, he was very charismatic, and he had this way of making each one of us feel like we were his favorite and, you know, totally loved and adored by him. And I think he did. That's how I felt. That's how he made me feel. But I think he did this for the other girls, too. But he also had this uncanny ability to size you up and fill your need, whatever. He could size up your need, your desires, your vulnerability, your weakness, and then he had the ability to, you know, like a changeling, be able to become whatever that person was that you needed.
Like a chameleon, really.
Like
huh?
A chameleon, yeah.
And you said at one point in your book, Charlie knew what you were afraid of. And preyed upon that, I think.
Yes, I think so.
And there was a sense of really kind of a pimp operation going on here, in a sense, to be blunt about it.
Covered by the whole counterculture, free love, get rid of your inhibitions. Yeah.
It's hard for people to understand now, and yet you want people to understand. You want people, you especially want this book to be a warning, don't you?
Yes, I do.
To, like, young people who might be caught up in cults and that sort of thing?
Yes, because I think that at 14, and this is, you know, I've heard this repeatedly, we all thought, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, we know it all. you know, and that seems to be even more so now in this day and age. They think they know it all and can do it all. And
did you feel that way at 14?
Oh, yes.
But you were also in search of a family, weren't you? You wanted that belonging and that identity,
yes,
as so many
I
young
did.
People do.
I wanted to be loved and adored and, you know, protected and...
Well, you were ultimately. I mean, the story has a more happy ending, but you kept it, as they say, on the download for many years.
Oh, very many years. And that probably that was as traumatic as, you know, the 2 years I spent with Charlie was keeping it on the down low. And, you know, people would talk about, oh, they're going to their 50th, you know, high school reunion. Well, I didn't go to high school. I didn't graduate from high school, so I didn't have a reunion to go to. Although, just so readers know, I do now have a master's degree and a teaching credential and, you know.
And you have a family?
I have a family. It's been a wonderful life.
Didn't the police officers adopted you, one of the police officers involved?
Well, they took me in as a foster child. They
yeah.
didn't actually adopt me, but, you know, I was a ward of the court, and they became my foster parents until I turned 18.
What about the other so-called Manson girls, Manson women? You know, Lizzie Van Houten is coming up again for parole, and a lot of people feel that she should be paroled, and they're behind her. John Waters, in fact, the author, has almost made it a cause celebre. You write about that, and you say she was gleeful after the LaBianca killings. These were murders that took place after the Sharon Tate and the rest of them were killed.
In her telling the story or telling her participation to me along with the other girls, yes, that was the overriding feeling that I got from her, is that she was almost like gleeful and bragging about it, which made it all the worse.
Would you testify against her if you were called to do that now as terms of a parole? Would you say she should not be paroled? Because she's all these reports say she's rehabilitated.
Originally, they got the death penalty. So they
yeah.
were, you know, that was overturned. I really, about her parole, I am not personally afraid, you know, if she were to be paroled. However, it's not for me to make that call. It's in the governor's hands now, and it's between her and God and the governor.
Since you mentioned God, you're a woman of faith now, right?
Yes.
And so was Susan Atkins. She found her way back to Jesus, and she was one of the most, you know, bloody murders in this whole terrible episode in our history. And so is Tex Watson, who probably, along with Susan Atkins, I don't know if you can judge these things or evaluate them, but was also a rank murderer. What do you feel about their taking Jesus as their savior?
I'm thrilled, you know. And again, you know, God will forgive them if they are, you know, if they ask for forgiveness and they are actually, you know, remorseful. I mean, but that's between them and God. But as far as, now that Charlie is gone, I think that's one more boogeyman behind us, you know, in American history. I have talked to young people who Charlie was the boogeyman. They were out on their paper route, you know, in the dark. And that's who, when they got scared, you know, hearing a noise or what, you know, it was like it was Charles that was after them, you know, where... When I grew up, it was
mind control, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I think that's the, you know, people just it's hard for them to accept them getting out when they had the death penalty originally. And then that was overturned to a life sentence. And I think that, you know, the victims' families, right now, that's my biggest concern, really. Every time someone is up for parole, they have to relive the horror of their loved one's demise. And I think that if they are truly, if Tex and, you know, Susan's gone now, but Tex, if he and Bruce, they claim to be that they are Christian. I think if they really have, you know, asked Christ into their lives and to their heart, that their biggest sacrifice would be to waive their parole, their right to a parole hearing, because every time there's a parole hearing, these families have to relive the horror. And it's not just one. There's, what, five, six of these people, and they come up for parole every couple of years.
Yeah, Tex Watson's become a pastor, in fact. We're talking to Diane Lake. She's co-author with Deborah Herman of Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson, Life Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s. So how'd you feel when you heard about Manson dying? Where were you at the time?
I was at home. And actually, it's interesting, my foster sister was the first one to text me and said, Charlie died.
Of course, in the courtroom, you kind of were broken from his spell even then when he yelled out during your testimony.
Yeah.
The way you describe
it. Don't put it all on Mr. Manson. She loved everybody.
Those were his words, yeah.
Yes. And it really did, you know, it just made me see he was just a player. So I feel relief. I feel relief for myself. I feel relief for the families of the victims. I feel relief for, you know, the society as a whole. I think that, you know, hopefully this is, you know, this will tone it down.
Well, one can hope. And let me, at this point, bring you, our callers, into this. You can join us toll-free, and we certainly welcome your calls, any questions or comments you might have for our guest, Diane Lake. She's the author of Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson's Life Inside a Cult, and The Darkness That Ended the 60s. Toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can join us now. This is a half-hour segment, so if you have something you'd like to ask or say to Diane Lake, this would be the time to call. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, but we do welcome your involvement in the program. And Diane Lake, why'd you keep your identity secret so long, and why'd you decide to open up?
I wanted to protect my children from any negative feedback. I mean, they certainly were not old enough. And even now, my oldest is, you know, 34. And I think that, you know, he has a copy of the book, but I told him, just read the prologue and the epilogue. You know, you might not want to read, and I don't necessarily want him to read some of the things that are, you know, in there, because it's his mom. So I wanted to protect my children. And now, you know, I have grandchildren that, you know, I need to also protect, but it was time. It was really time, and I'm so glad that I wrote the book, because it was very cathartic for me.
And you had lost your husband previous to that.
I lost my husband a little over three and a half years ago now. And so I was just kind of lost without him, and I was looking for to reinvent, you know, kind of reinvent my basis of life. And I had this epiphany that now was the time to write my story. And the kids were old enough, and I've been in a community long enough. Everyone is, they're shocked and amazed. They thought I was just this robust suburban mom and choir lady or church lady. I've had, you know, people comment about that. So, but everybody's very supportive. Actually, the response has been, you know, really, really positive so far. And
Do you still have a kitten named Charlie?
Yes, my daughter got a kitten from a friend of hers like 17 years ago now, but she named him Charlie. And
at first you were resistant, but you couldn't tell her why,
right? Oh, I did not want her to name this cat Charlie. But actually, it really kind of opened the door and was therapeutic for me because right now, when you say Charlie, I think of, you know, Charlie Manson. But for many years, it was, when somebody said Charlie, my first thought was this cute little black kitten.
Well, there's a TV show called Charlie's Girls, and they used to make those analogies, I know. Did you feel, by the way, you know, Patty Hearst was described as being under the Stockholm Syndrome, you know, that she was brainwashed. Did you feel, I mean, you were an adolescent, you were a child, really, but did you feel that that was something that you experienced, that so-called Stockholm Syndrome?
I'm not sure what the Stockholm syndrome is.
Well, you become a total believer in the person who is keeping you captive, essentially, or making you part of their mind control.
Yes, I would say that's very much true.
Well, let's hear what our listeners have to say or ask, and we begin calling with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the guest, what was the awareness of the members of the family that Manson's project was to foment a race war by creating signs that would lead to...
I'm sorry, we've got a bad connection here, Colin, but I think he's asking about the Helter Skelter race war, you know, the belief that the Beatles lyrics were somehow leading toward the reason for killing these people, these innocent people. In other words, they were going to put things on the wall and blood and all the rest. And did you know about that?
Yes, that was at the time that things really turned. But Charlie had always been talking about a race war. This is something that he had learned in his years in prison and reform school. From an early age, he had been indoctrinated into this idea that there was going to be a race war, that, you know, Blackie was going to rise up and, you know,
kill white people.
And kill white people. And so I think in his delusion, you know, it became that we were going to hide from this, and that, you know, like a phoenix, you know, rising from the ashes, when it was all said and done and over, then, you know, he and his family, or his, you know, group of beautiful people, were going to, you know, repopulate the earth, kind of. I mean, it just sounds crazy, but that is what it was. And then the Beatles White Album came out, and he was sure that these were for profits sending him a message through the White Album, and that this race war now got the moniker Helter Skelter.
He really believed this, you're convinced.
He had forestry maps, you know, taped together over a very large area of the Spahn Ranch Saloon, and he was looking for a path to the desert. He believed that there was this bottomless pit, and that we were going to escape Helter Skelter on, you know, with the dune buggies. And that's when the acquisition of dune buggies and motorcycles and gas tanks and all that escalated. And, you know, he gave us all buck knives and, you know, to defend ourselves. And so in my mind, that's what it was.
And there was also a time when you were actually living with, I believe, Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys, and Terry Melcher, Doris Day's son, got involved in this whole notion that Manson had, that he would become a rock star himself and make sort of reminds me of Hitler thinking he was going to be a painter or something along those lines. You know, he was a frustrated artist, some kind of an artist. But what I learned from your book is, you know, I thought it would be wanting to be a rock star for the adulation and all that went with that. It was mainly to have money, right, to be in the desert?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that, you know, actually his experience with Dennis Wilson, I mean, was a lovely home, and, you know, it was fun being there, and Dennis adored Charlie, seemingly adored him. But when it came to actually starting the recording process, Charlie didn't want to really, they wanted to change him, they wanted to change the words, they wanted to change, you know, the way he wore his hair and how he dressed, and he really didn't, I don't think he wanted to be a rock star bad enough, or he would have made the changes that they wanted him to.
But he thought he had some musical talent, and that's, I guess, rather moot maybe to this day. Let me get Delta on next. Delta, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have a question, please, speaker. And this is the question particularly given that she is a religious person now. I am not religious myself at all, but I do believe that evil is a force. That manifests. So my question is, during your time with Manson, did you ever at any point observe any sort of phenomena or supernatural phenomena that gave you the feeling that there was something, that it was connected with evil or a manifestation of evil in any way, or not? That's my question.
Do you ever feel anything diabolic or satanic or along those lines, I think? She's asking.
No. He did have this ability, we called it postulating, he called it postulating, which just meant thinking, okay, we need a car, we need gas, we need money, we need food. And he had this ability, seeming ability, and maybe he was manipulating this behind the scenes. But it seemed like 9 times out of 10, what we needed would materialize.
You didn't know
not magically, but...
there seemed to be something clairvoyant. Yeah. But you also write about understanding later when you became educated that a lot of the things that he used were, you know, things like Scientology and Scripture. And I mean, he spent a lot of time in prison, so he did a lot of reading and so forth. Here's Deborah, who writes, Manson was a waste of human life. What's your response when you hear statements like that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, hopefully, you know, I always want to think that, you know, what man tries to make evil, you know, God can turn it into good. So maybe the lesson with Charles is, you know, especially coming out now at the same time that, you know, Harvey Weinstein, you know, the casting couch, you know, reality is being exposed, that, you know, this is a cautionary tale. It's huge. And I'm, you know, it just breaks my heart that lives were lost in the process. But, you know, maybe it's just a really big cautionary tale that, you know, we need to protect our young people from being, you know, preyed upon by predators.
Here's Johnny. Johnny, join us.
Hey. Hi, how are you? My question is about Linda Kasabian. I guess it was back in 72. I was living in Nashua, New Hampshire, and I was in a bar, and I sat down next to her, and I got the most horrible chill. Now, I'm black. And after I got up and walked away, people told me who she was, and she was a scary lady. And I was just wondering what your comments were on her.
Well, we should know, the listeners don't, she was one of the members of the Manson family. Linda Kasabian?
Linda Kasabian really hadn't been with us very long when she became, you know, was enlisted as the driver.
Yeah, she's still in prison, in fact. She's still in prison.
Linda Kasabian? No,
no, she gave testimony, I'm sorry.
Yeah, she was given immunity.
Yeah, that's right.
For her testimony.
She scary? Was she scary?
You know, I really don't know Linda well enough because she came, you know, in the last few months before the murders, and I really don't know her well enough to make any comment about whether she was scary or not. The fact that she that Charlie was able to recruit her to be the driver is amazing.
But it was her testimony and your testimony that essentially really sent the Manson family to prison.
Yes.
And I want to read a comment here from a listener who expresses some gratitude to you and says, I was 19 in 1969, met a few people like Manson, and I'm so glad I did not get involved in anything like that. Thank you for growing up to be a wonderful human being, teacher, wife, and mother.
Thank you.
And thank you for being with us. I appreciate the time. Diane Lake, author with Deborah Herman of The Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson, Life Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s. And when we return, we're going to talk about earthquakes, not only here in California, but nationally. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.